Today on CyberWork, Alyssa Miller, hacker, security researcher, advocate, and international public speaker joins us. Alyssa spoke to me about the easiest pen test she ever ran on an app. You're going to want to hear that story. The importance of diversity of hiring and not just diversity of thought, and give some of the best advice I've heard yet on picking your cybersecurity path. You don't want to miss this one, so check it out today on CyberWork. Also, get excited because our second annual CyberWork Live event is coming up in just a few days. On Wednesday, June 23rd at 11 a.m. Central Time, I welcome Ayman Galani, Curtis Brazell, and Ken Jenkins to talk about red teaming. If you have any questions about red team operations, how to get started, or anything else about this exciting profession, email them to me at cyberwork@infosecinstitute.com, and we'll do our best to answer them live on the air. That's Wednesday, June 23rd at 11 a.m. Go to infosecinstitute.com/events to sign up and be in the virtual audience live. Without further ado, let's start the show. Welcome to this week's episode of the CyberWork with InfoSec podcast. Each week, we talk with a different industry thought leader about cybersecurity trends, the way those trends affect the work of InfoSec professionals, and offer tips for breaking in or moving up the ladder in the cybersecurity industry. Alyssa Miller is a hacker, security researcher, advocate, and international public speaker with over 15 years of experience in cybersecurity. From a young age, she has enjoyed exploring and deconstructing technology to learn more about how it works. At 12 years old, she bought her first computer. From that $1,000 purchase, she launched a hobby that would become her career. Just 7 years later, she was hired to her full-time salary job as a programmer. Alyssa is also passionate that doing better in security begins with sharing knowledge and learning from each other. She regularly presents her perspectives through public speaking engagements, speaking at various industry conferences, vendor and customer hosted events, and non-security related events. Alyssa's mission is to improve all aspects of the security community. Therefore, her topics range from technical to strategic to higher level community and policy issues. Alyssa is also a member of the Women in Cybersecurity Racial Equity Committee. She additionally participates in other organizations designed to build a more welcoming and cooperative culture in security. As a member of ISACA, Alyssa currently holds a Certified Information Security Manager certification, and she is also the author of the Cyber Defender's Career Guide, published by Manning in May 2021. So we're going to be discussing all of Alyssa's fascinating story today, her career journey, the work of demystifying cybersecurity, and her work to create a more inclusive and welcoming space in the cybersecurity industry. Alyssa, welcome to CyberWork.
Hey, thanks, Chris. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. So we like to, you know, usually start by getting the story of our guest's cybersecurity journey in their own words. And, you know, your bio lays out your passion for computers bare. You know, your paper route at age 12 that you used to pay for a new computer shows beyond a doubt that you've always been passionate about this stuff. So what was the initial appeal?
Yeah, so honestly, it started even younger than that. I mean, yeah. I can go back to when I was 4 years old and my dad was an accountant for a company. Well, first off, you know, even at 4 years old, like I was that kid who took everything apart.
Right.
You know, any toys I had, whatever, you know, electronics that were lying around the house, like a radio that stopped working or something, I always took stuff apart because I wanted to figure out how it worked. And if it was broken, I wanted to see if I could figure out how to fix it. You know, I mean, kind of, I guess, ambitious at 4 years old.
That's awesome. But, yeah.
But my dad,
I can't do that now.
My father.
Anyway.
So my father was an accountant for this like small heating and cooling company. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I remember when I was 4 years old, they were switching over from one accounting system to the other. And, you know, a small company, especially back then, they weren't open over the holidays, you know, so like that from Christmas to New Year's, there was like, you know, there wasn't really anybody in the office. So he didn't really want to go in. He had to work on converting all the books now from the old system to the new. And so he didn't want to go into the office. So my father probably never thought of it this way, but in 1981, that's how old I am. Mm-hmm. He was kind of pioneering work from home. He brought home this huge Zenith computer with the disk drives and everything else. But the reason I bring it up is because that's where I got into computers, because he had this computer. And when he wasn't working on it while it was at home, he was letting me play video games on it.
Oh. I love it.
And so that just got me started. Then I was fortunate enough that in grade school, we had computers. First, it was TRS-80s.
There you go.
Then we built a Apple lab, and I started staying after school, learning how to do basic programming.
Wow.
And like you said, at 12, I bought my own computer.
Right.
And, you know, did some more programming and found my way into Prodigy.
Okay.
Without a subscription. You know, so things that, you know, thank God the CFAA has a certain statute of limitations. Because, you know.
You are not our first guest to have a similar story.
I'm sure. Yeah. I am sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, but what's funny is through all that, I still didn't see really tech being my career.
Mm-hmm.
And, it, you know, I started as a pre-med major at Marquette University.
Okay.
But after three semesters of college level chemistry, I was just like, peace out. I'm done. I'm not doing this. And so, you know, but now I'm scrambling, find a, you know, I got to go through the course catalog, what degree program, and they had a computer science degree.
Mm-hmm.
I'm reading about it. I'm like, oh, this is all programming. I know how to program. This will be easy.
Right.
Yeah. It'll be easy. Good idea.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask about that. I'm sorry. I wanted to ask about that. I mean, cause, yeah. just I keep going, but I was going to say, I noticed that in your sort of like your bio on LinkedIn, like you were working already in sort of a programming role, but then you also went to school for computer science at the same time. Can you talk about your experiences taking this kind of high stakes job while also going to school to learn and increase the same skills you're using in your day-to-day operations?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, first of all, I mean, I told you how old I am. So,
right.
You know, yeah, if you do the math on this, you figure out that I was in college during the dot-com boom.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so here I had skills. I actually was at that point now, I had a part-time job doing technical support for a software company here in Wisconsin. And, you know, but I'm still going to school and whatever. And it was just, it was the dot-com boom. I mean, they were desperate for programmers, right, wherever they could find them. And so I had a little bit of programming experience that I got at that job, but I also had all of what I had done on my own, mm-hmm, and I'm in school for it. So I went after this job. I got it, you know, working for a financial technologies company as a software developer in their home banking division. So, you know, doing all that online bill pay and banking. In fact, okay, honestly, it was dial up and touch tone as well.
Yeah.
Internet banking was just getting started, wow, right? Like they were just diving into that.
Yep.
So a lot of what I did, I mean, I was supporting, you know, Raycal modems and racks with T1s plugged into them. And I had to learn VB 1.5, I think, wow, because for the touch tone system, the Dialogic cards that that was the only thing you could, that was the only programming, right, language you could use for them. Just weird stuff. But yeah, it was just an opportunity for me just taking advantage of kind of the situation the world was in.
Right.
And like, hey, you know, this is what I'm looking to do in my career anyway. By this point, I already had a kid, mm-hmm, so needed a good job that had health insurance and all that.
Right.
And yeah, it was just something I made work. I mean, I switched schools a couple times, okay, whatever, took some time off before I finally finished my degree. But yeah, working full time, doing the full time school thing. And then I got really silly and decided to get a master's degree too.
Yeah, I was gonna ask about the studies. You know, did you have a sense of your graduate and undergrad work solidifying or strengthening the self-teaching you had already done, or did you just kind of feel like you needed the degree for the type of work you wanted to do? Like, where was the sort of level of like, did it really kick your butt, or was it like, I already know all this, but I just kind of want to get it sort of systematized in an academic setting?
So it's actually a really good question, because I mean, initially it was just like, look, I got to finish college, right? I'm in school. I'm not doing the pre-med thing anymore. I got to do something else. And it's like, okay, well, this would be a good career field to get into.
Yeah.
So I'll get a degree there. What I did that was actually, I'm really glad I did, was I got out of the computer science degree and actually switched into more of what we used to call an MIS degree.
Okay.
Where it was still computers, but now it was more of a business focus.
Oh,
so like, okay. I mean, I literally had to take accounting classes.
Right. Got it.
And so that was actually a really good switch, because it helped me see the applicability of technology to an overall business environment and start to understand the broader scope of, okay, technology is a piece of this, but it drives this bigger picture. So it was, you know, and then with, you know, when I got my master's, it was the same thing. I mean, I debated an MBA,
mm-hmm,
and then decided, well, in fact, actually I went to someone in my HR team at the time and I said, like, look, I'm looking at this MBA, or there's this management or manager of information systems,
right,
degree. And what he told me is like, that MBA, I see 100 of those come across my desk every day. He's like, this degree over here, this information systems one, I don't see that. So yeah. I would recommend you go get that because that's going to stand out, and where you want to go in your career, that's going to apply better. And I think that was a good move too.
Yeah.
Because again, it had a lot of the content like you would get in the MBA as far as like business and that sort of thing, but it wasn't as heavy on things like accounting and reporting and the things that, you know, I got more out of the security side of it or the information systems side.
And it sounds like it was very sort of tightly tied to what you were studying already as well.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So, and it tightly tied to the job I was in too.
Right.
I mean, that was it as well. Like, okay, at this point, you know, I was now, you know, leading a team, and I think by the end of it, I'm trying to remember. Yeah. So I think it'd been right after I graduated is when I first made the shift over to security then.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you sort of speak to how has the landscape changed at all? Do you feel like if you see someone, I don't know how much hiring you do, but if you see someone with, you know, an MIS degree come across or something, you know, do you think that the sort of academic credentials are still as important in job hunting these days, or has that changed at all?
So that's kind of what do I think versus what is the,
what's the perception in the world? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately the industry is still pretty focused on people having degrees and degrees in the specific field. You mentioned before the book that I wrote and some of the investigation and research I did for that book was into job descriptions. And it's, you know, most of the job descriptions you see still list that they want a 4-year degree. And when they do, they always say they want it in a technology field, which, you know, for security is, in my opinion, is wrong. Just plain blunt. It's wrong.
Yeah.
You know, it's a good thing to have. It's an asset, but you know what? I'll take somebody with a degree in English.
Right.
Because you know what? They'll be a great writer.
Yeah.
And they'll be able to do, you know, if they have the technical aptitude to learn some of the security side of it, you know, that's a skill set that a lot of people in security don't have. Or maybe, you know, somebody with some other arts degree or something. I mean, like, you know, security, we want that diversity of people. We really need it.
Right.
Because when you think about collective problem solving, which is really what security is.
Yes.
You know, when you want that collective problem solving, it gets stronger when we have those diverse backgrounds and ideas coming together.
Yeah.
And so if we get everybody has followed that same path, they've been, you know, a programmer or a sysadmin or something like that, and then they pivot into security. You know, that gets us such a myopic view of the world that it's...
Yeah, you're not thinking as laterally as you could be.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I have lots of guests on here who talk about stories like that, like the digital forensic specialist who said like her best team member was a former child psychologist who was able to, you know, look into, you know, if you had to sort of look through 10,000 phone messages to figure out, you know, what was going on with this particular case, like the child psychologist is going to have a better sense of like, okay, I understand this pattern of behavior and things like that. And that just sort of spreads out through the entire industry, I imagine.
Yeah. And I mean, there's so many great stories like that of people who've come in that way.
Right.
I mean, I've hired some of them. One of my favorite people in security actually is Alith Dennis. She didn't work in IT at all. And now she's got a black badge from DEF CON.
Wow.
I mean,
that's awesome.
So there's space for everybody.
Yeah, that's great. So so I want to move back. Your bio noted that you moved from a lead programming role into penetration testing. What was the initial appeal of pen testing versus programming? Just that it looks awesome.
I don't know if there was one.
Oh, really? It just sort of happened?
So what happened was, you know, working, you know, in the programming role, obviously I'd worked with the InfoSec team many, many times. Large organization, you know, many projects where we had to engage with our security team. And at one point, the manager of what was the security test team for that organization came to me and asked if I'd be interested in joining her team.
Mm-hmm.
She was building it out. And I actually said to her, I'm like, well, it sounds kind of cool. You know, I mean, that whole idea of, hey, I'm going to break our system so I can tell you how before the bad guys do it. Okay, that sounds cool. But I said, I don't know anything about pen testing. I've never done it before. And she's like, you're smart. You'll figure it out. That's why I came to you.
Mm.
So you don't hear someone say that to you and then turn them down.
No.
Right. Like, right. I mean, at that point it was like, all right, I definitely got to check this out. And yeah, sure enough. I mean, I got into it with the developer background. Of course, AppSec was really my niche. That's where okay. I fit best. You know, we had at that point now we're, you know, mid 2000s and web apps and e-commerce and everything are really, really, really taking off.
Yes.
So we had plenty of web applications in particular that needed to be, looked at and taken care of. And, you know, I've got some pretty wild stories of some of the things that I found.
Please. But, tell me about it. So I was going to ask if you had any kind of like crazy war stories or unconventional sure. hacks or tactics that you found.
Yeah. I mean, the one I always tell is the web app that I was able to pop a shell on in under 3 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah, which is scary as hell, right?
Yeah.
Well, at least it's scary when it's your organization that you're popping.
There's a strongly worded report at the end of that, I imagine.
Yeah, it was not good.
Yeah.
So it was a web project management application.
Okay.
And I get in there, and so it's got a file upload utility. All right. Well, I'm instantly interested. And I mean, this is all an initial recon, right? Like mm-hmm. I just logging in.
Yeah.
I immediately find this file upload. Okay, well, I'm going to play with this right away because I want to see this.
Yeah, you're just in the initial notes phase at this point, I imagine, right?
Yeah, yeah. I'm literally just trying to figure out what does this app even do?
Right.
So I find this file upload. I'm like, well, let's see. So I start uploading files with weird extensions. I can upload an ASP file. It's written in classic ASP. This is even, you know, .NET was still just kind of getting going.
Right.
So it's written in classic ASP. All right. Can I put this somewhere else? And I start playing with directory traversal. And of course that works just like that, .../, and I can throw it wherever the hell I want. Oh no, this is too good. So now I take it and can I throw it in WebRoot? Yes. So I grabbed, I don't even remember who wrote it at the time. There was an ASP shell just, you know, out there in what today we call it in the open source world.
Right.
I downloaded it. It's, you know, ASP that basically gives you a command prompt on the box.
Wow.
So I upload that into WebRoot. I fire it up. I hit it. I come up first take command. Who am I? It was the IIS user. Second, look at the groups, administrators.
Wow.
I mean, I'm like game over. I don't even have to do anymore. Yeah. Like I can literally do anything to this app, to
right.
this server. I can pivot. I can do whatever I want.
You were probably imagining like days of work or just fiddling and tinkering, and you're like, well, there it is, right there, in the front,
yeah,
right, and the front door is open.
I'm like, you got to be kidding me!
And wow.
What sucks about that though is it does make doing the rest of the pen test really hard.
Right.
Because now you want to find all the other vulnerabilities, but you got like this really cool one that you can do anything with, and so I'm like, oh,
gotta pretend that's not there.
Down.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, I will say I did cheat. Then like I used that access to find sure. other vulnerabilities because I could find things easier too. I could, you know, I download the entire source code of the website. It was supposed to be more black box than that.
Right.
I wasn't supposed to have access to code, but it's all written in classic ASP. So it's all just, the code is there.
Yeah.
You know, I was able to download the ASP files. So that was easy enough. And then, yeah, that led me all sorts of directions. And of course, I mean, there's everything from SQL injection to, you know, problems with cookies and session tokens, you name it. I mean,
yeah.
it was a nightmare, as you can imagine.
It's more holes in fabric. From, yeah.
Yeah. All stemming from one little, you know, file upload.
So, you know, as I understand it, it sounds like you were kind of doing pen testing at the sort of dawn of the art. And, you know, when you find these, like these crazy vulnerabilities like this, was this especially egregious even for the time, or was it just that people weren't thinking about AppSec as tightly as they are now? And, you know, everyone was this wide open. Do you have a sense?
I mean, some of it was egregious. I mean, we definitely knew better than to be running IIS under an administrator.
Okay.
Like, come on, you
yeah.
know, I mean, some of the things with directory traversal. Yeah. I mean, this was, I think, we were getting close to almost 2010 at this point.
Oh, wow.
So,
okay.
You know, OWASP Top 10 had been out.
Yes.
Know,
okay.
version of that came out in, what, 2003?
Right.
And I think we had a subsequent one in 2007. So, you know, I mean, some of this was known, but
right.
it was still pretty early for devs. Like, they weren't there And unfortunately, you know, with an organization at that point, I think we had like maybe 1200 applications. You know, you would love to test them all before they go to production, but it's just not, that's not feasible. Right. And so unfortunately, yeah, this one did hit our production environment. Thankfully, we found it before it became something that someone else was going to exploit. Wow. And yeah. I mean, we actually shut it down, because it was that bad.
Oh yeah.
You know, took it down for a couple days, and devs who probably hated me ever since, you know, were working night and day to get this thing updated, tested. And, you know, the easy one was, you know, fixing the file upload. It was actually the IIS thing. It was harder because of course they had to regression test the whole thing to make sure that when they, you know, that they had all the permissions right and all that crazy stuff. So,
wow.
Yeah.
So to that end, I mean, you know, that's a great story, and I'm so glad you told it, but you know, I also want to know sort of, was that a difficult, it doesn't sound like that was a difficult challenge compared to some of the other sort of pen testing things you do. And I ask that only to pivot to the fact that I wanted to sort of get a sense of, if you can think of some key moments in your life or career when a big change happened, whether it was a job change or a big project that gave you new tools or new opportunities. Can you think of things like, aha, I just kind of leveled up, you know?
Oh my God. There's a laundry list.
Okay.
I mean, obviously just that manager coming to me and saying, hey, do you want to join this pen testing team?
Yeah, that's amazing.
You know, after that, it was, we had a merger in that company where we got bought out by, we were a company of about 5,500. We got bought out by a company of about 28,000. Mm-hmm. And you know, through merger, as things do, you know, they're cutting people and whatever. Well, I ended up leading not only that team, but now bringing in all the people from the other organization that I was leading across, you know, multiple countries. Mm-hmm. And I had ownership for the entire vulnerability management program and security testing program. And this is, I mean, I was like in my early 30s.
Wow. Yeah.
So, you know, that was a big one for me. And unfortunately, I didn't really look at it that way until more recently, because imposter syndrome does its thing, right? You know, something serendipitously happens to you. You get a really cool thing. You don't really give yourself credit for it.
Right.
But yeah, looking back on it now, like, oh my God, for, you know, I was running the entire vulnerability management program for a Fortune 200 company in financial technologies, no less.
Yeah.
You know, I think, there's been a number, some have been good, some have been bad, right? I mean, I had an issue far more recently with an organization I was at where I got passed over for promotion and under very, very questionable circumstances. And so that's one of those down moments that really kind of kicked me, you know, into a bad space because of course, you know, I could sit there and I could say, okay, this is really questionable. I really think something else is going on here, but you still take it to heart and you start to question yourself. And so you lose that confidence. And so that was actually a defining moment too, because I'd still be at that organization had I gotten that promotion. But instead I left and went to work for another company. While I was there, a couple things happened that like really built me up again. One was I was contacted as part of an executive search for one of the big three social media companies. They ended up, it was a new role that they were creating. They ended up not creating the role as it turned out later. So, you know, I didn't get that, but that was like they reached out to me with an executive search, right? So that right there kind of, you know,
that's a great message.
Confidence is coming back.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then it was, you know, I think the biggest thing was now landing this role that I'm in now as a business information security officer. This is one of those things like, wow, this is really cool. Because after I'd been at that financial services company for a long time, I left and went into consulting. I spent, you know, the next 8 years in consulting. And so coming now to S&P in this BISO role was a return, first of all, to working in a corporate environment where you can make things happen and you're actually a part of seeing them happen and you own them.
Yeah.
Right. You don't get that in consulting. But now I'm in a position where, okay, I own security strategy for an entire division.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you know, multi-billion dollar a year revenue division.
Right.
One of four within S&P Global. And like that, I mean, you know, talk about a moment where you just feel like you've arrived.
Yeah.
Like, here I am. This is my shot. I've got a chance now to really do something meaningful for a big company that's, you know, fairly prominent. Most
right.
people have heard of the S&P 500 and
for
the
sure.
Dow Jones Industrial, you know, okay.
Yeah.
You know, that's part of what we do. Most people know about Standards and Poor and their, you know, the credit ratings, which that's my division.
Okay.
And so, you know, not one of the big three media companies had that job worked out. I mean, that would have been really huge too, but you know, almost equally as prominent and definitely so in the business world.
Now, I know most of the job titles, but I don't really know the specifics of what a BISO, business information security officer, like, you know, we talk to a lot of CISOs and we talk to CTOs and so forth. Can you give me what the distinction is between a BISO, CISO, and some of the others are C-suite people?
Yeah. So, and get this question a lot because it is a new role, and actually it varies a bit based on which organization you're in. Some organizations implement the concept very, very differently than others. But for me in this role, the way it ultimately works out too is it's very similar to like a divisional CISO. You know, typically when organizations have large divisions like that, you might have a central CISO who's at the, you know, kind of the corporate level, but then
right.
each division has their own CISO as well.
Sure.
And usually those CISOs report into that centralized CISO function. So my role is similar in that I oversee security for our division, but this is where the B comes into play. And it's B for business because I report into the business line and, you know, into the CTO's organization. And my focus is not exclusive to security. It's bridging the gap between security and the centralized CISO function at our organization. So really bringing those security initiatives, all the strategy that's coming down from that centralized organization, and building out my strategy for how that's going to apply given the context of our business. So how do I make this meaningful? How do I apply this frictionlessly? How do I make sure that it plugs into our pipelines and our SDLC processes the way that we need it to keep the business going and to actually enable the business to move quicker. And then on the flip side, it's also bringing the message the other direction, which is bringing that business context to the security team
okay.
in the central organization
right.
and helping them understand, okay, if you guys want to deploy this DLP solution, here's things you need to understand because A, we're heavily regulated. So here's how it's got to, you know, here's some of the requirements it's going to have. Here's, we need processes here and here and here because these people need to be able to do things that are going to be exceptions to the DLP policy that you're proposing.
Okay.
You know, things like that, all of that kind of work is a part of it too. And so it's, I was just talking with a friend last night and the way she termed it, it's like the great translator.
Right.
Between, you know, the security organization and the rest of the business.
So that you're not having, you know, you're not creating these things in a vacuum. You're letting them know you can't just make this sort of beautiful object exactly the way you want it. It has to be able to serve the business in this way. Is that sort of the idea?
Yeah, exactly.
And
sometimes it's forcing accountability both directions
okay.
too. Like, you know, my security team's going to come and say, we want this new thing. We want to implement this new process. Well, why?
Right.
Show me why. Show me the business value, or let's talk about it and let's find the business value. Because I know on the back end, I've got, you know, engineering teams and product teams and everyone else that I have to, you know, justify this to.
Yeah.
And if it's going to introduce friction, that's problematic. So
right.
how do we adjust for that? And then, of course, the other direction, too. How do I make sure that my teams are accountable for addressing their vulnerabilities and doing the things that they need to do? Are they getting the necessary architecture reviews and following our architecture standards and things like that?
Okay. Now, a lot of our listeners, we have a wide range, but a good chunk of our listeners are, you know, have said in polls that they have 0 to 4 years of cybersecurity experience, and they're here to sort of learn about the industry and the, you know, what roles do I want to start with and which ladder do I want to climb up and stuff. So can you talk a little bit about what the primary skills are that are required for a BISO as opposed to other sort of C-suite level things? What should they be working on at lower levels in their careers to sort of prepare them if they want to do something like that, as opposed to like a CISO?
Yeah. So the technical skills are always important, mostly because it's what people are looking for. And you do have to have the technical aptitude, you know, in a lot of these jobs. Sure. But honestly, it's the most underrated skill, and everybody's going to kind of roll their eyes like that. Oh, that's such a soft answer, but empathy.
Yeah. Oh, empathy, okay.
More than anything.
I love that.
The ability to actually look at the people that you're dealing with, whether they're your engineers, your SREs, your DBAs, your product managers, your InfoSec team, and understand what drives them and how you can motivate them. You know, I mean, we hear so often, it's funny, you hear managers pontificate that, oh, well, I can teach anybody how to use this technical tool. I need them to show passion. And
yeah,
other
soft
things.
Skills. Yeah.
And, you know, it's, or what I call core transferable skills, because they're those things that, like, you might have learned working as a barista, how to take a bunch of inputs really fast and prioritize them and execute on them and quality and all those things that a barista does. Well, if you think about that in those terms, take the coffee portion out of it and just focus on it at that level, that's a transferable skill that would work really well for someone in your SOC, for instance.
Right.
And so, you know, there is that, there's just the awareness of some of the security concepts. So like, I, you know, people come to me all the time, they ask about, you know, what certification should I get? And, you know, I'm not a big fan of certifications as training, because a lot of them aren't. A lot of them are designed to really, you know, justify that you have the skills that you've already learned versus actually train you up for them. But one of the ones I do point people to is the Security Plus, because what I like about Security Plus, first of all, for someone new to the industry, it's easily attainable.
Yes.
Right. It's not super expensive. It's not a $4,000 SANS course.
Yep.
It's not, you know, the CISSP where you got to have 5 years of experience just to get it.
Yeah.
You know, so I point them that way. And partially too, because, you know, CompTIA has done a really nice job with the training that goes along with that. And so what the Security Plus gives you is it gives you that well-rounded view of a lot of different, you know, security spaces, the basics of, like, you know, here's the security domains and here's concepts of things like least privilege, separation of duties, zero trust, all of that kind of stuff, where I want people to understand that more than I necessarily want them to understand how to write a query in Splunk.
Right. Right. Okay. Yeah. That feathers nicely into my next question. I want to talk about your new book, the Cyber Defender's Career Guide, which was published last month. It sounds like the perfect book for our listeners, as it's aimed to things we've been talking about here all the time, like adapting your existing skills into cybersecurity roles and figuring out how your individual skills or interests can help you choose the particular flavor of cybersecurity that's best suited to you. So you mentioned a little bit already, but what can our listeners look forward to if they buy your book?
So one correction, hasn't actually been published yet.
Oh.
So what is available is it's available for pre-purchase.
Ah,
when
I've been given bad intel.
Pre-purchase,
okay.
What you get, and this is something that's really cool about Manning Publications, my publisher, and this is part of the reason why when they came to me, I was excited to go with them, is it's in what they call their Manning Early Access Program.
Ah.
So you can pre-purchase the book either in print or, you know, ebook format. So when it is published, it's yours. But what you get is you get early access to the book. So we've got right now the first five chapters available. Now they're not finalized, right? I mean, you'll go in there, you're going to find, you know, even just simple copy edit things like, you know, spelling or grammar errors.
Oh, behind the scenes.
I can tell you right now that, you know, like the first chapter is going to break up into two different chapters, things like that, you know, so I'm still working on the book. I've got two more chapters to finish.
Gotcha.
And, you know, there's going to be nine chapters total. But so you get to start reading it right away. And what's really cool about that is not only do you get access to it early, but you actually, you can send me feedback.
Right.
Like they have a forum that you can send feedback to the publisher, or you, you know, people follow me on Twitter or LinkedIn or whatever, you know, just let me know. What do you think? Did I really miss the boat on something?
Wow.
Is there something else you wish I covered?
Yeah.
So yeah, if you go and you buy this MEAP version of the book, you get all that and you're going to get the book when it's done.
Right. And you kind of get to watch it being sort of crafted, I imagine, too. If you're looking at it now and then it comes later and you say, oh, that's different than how it was before, yeah, that, you know, that stretches your brain all the further. Was there anything?
I mean, you know, it's not going to change massively.
No, of course.
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, you know, so it's not like you got to worry about, like, I read all this and it totally changed. Well, no,
right,
it,
right,
you know, it, I might've added some things or whatever, but yeah, I, you know, like I said, I'm going to take one chapter and split it into two just because the first chapter is really, really long, you know?
Right. I so, love that.
Things like that.
Now, was there anything that you discovered or realized in the writing of the book that even surprised you? And are you considering writing more books in addition to your other projects?
So the first thing that I found was, honestly, not even related to book writing directly. It was the impact that COVID had.
Oh, really? Okay.
I started this book, I think I started authoring it in March of last year and had planned to have it done last year.
Right.
But, you know, the impact of COVID just, and I know I'm not the only author who experienced this. Yeah. It was huge. It slowed everything down in terms of just even trying to find time and motivation to work on it. Right.
Yes.
I mean, you're sitting there and, you know, you're in your house all day. And now all the things that I had planned to do to, like, set aside my time for writing the book suddenly all shifted.
Yes.
Aside from that, something else I learned is peer review in the book process is really interesting because, you know, at least this publisher, I don't know, I assume other publishers do the same. You know, as I release chunks of the book, they send it out for peer review to get feedback. And it's really interesting to read those because you get many different personalities and some of them are downright brutal.
Wow.
You know, like there is one person who's been in both rounds of peer review who I don't know if he knows me outside the space and he doesn't like me, but you know, the way that he approaches it is it's brutal. And,
yeah,
and sometimes, yeah, I mean, there's things that he'll say, you know, people at my publisher are not cybersecurity experts. So they're right, reading this and they're like, he's saying this, this, and this, and that you're wrong. I'm like, no, that's one opinion of how to look at the,
yeah,
world. It, you know, it, so that's been really eye-opening to me, that process. It's really good. You know, in the end, I mean, I'm not complaining. Don't get me wrong. I've always been taught with feedback like that, you take what you can use.
Yep.
If you can't use it, you just forget about it.
There you go.
No. And I mean, I do take it to heart. That's not to say I've completely dismissed any of the heavy, heavy, brutal reviews that I've gotten from this one individual. You know, I do try to consider why does this person feel this way about these things? And then you read the others where, you know, many of the others like glowing reviews, like they love the, you
right,
know, the things that he's complaining about are the other things that people say they love.
The best part of it, yeah.
So it's like, you do have to balance it. So that was really eye-opening for me too. Would I write another one? We'll see.
Okay.
I mean, this was something I was already kind of looking into anyway. And so when the publisher approached me and said, hey, we'd really like you to write a book on this topic, it was like, you know, all right, I've got the necessary research. I'm going to add some other research to it. I mean, spoiler alert here, I actually had a publisher 4 months earlier that had approached me to write basically the same book.
Okay.
But at that point, I didn't have any research. I didn't have anything. So I turned them down.
Mm-hmm.
But so I think I would have to be in that situation again, where I had done enough really heavy duty research into a particular topic that wasn't getting a lot of attention and, you know, felt ready to write a book on it. You know, in this case, this book, one of the things that really makes it, in my opinion, stand out is that, you know, there's a number of books on, you know, how to get into a pen testing role. You know, and people tend to think about security jobs in terms of offensive security.
Right.
This book is written to cover any job in security. So, I mean, I think it's chapter 2 or chapter 3, I talk about roles in security, might even be chapter 1. I talk about roles in security. I cover sales.
Yeah.
social engineering.
Yep.
You know, operational security. So your SOC analysts, things like that.
Yeah.
Application security, of course. Mm-hmm. I mean, how could I write a book and not talk about application security? But all of these things that, you know, people don't traditionally think of.
Yeah.
As part of the security landscape. And so covering that broader scope of, you know, here's how you do it. And it's very little of the book talks about building technical skills.
Right.
Like, you know, I'm not going to tell you, well, you need to go build a lab and do all these things. Sure. I covered that.
Yeah.
That's such a small component of the overall. There are far bigger hills to climb
right.
in order to get that first job. And that's really what the book focuses on.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked to, you know, risk analysts and threat modelers and, you know, all kinds of things where it's, you know, you're the most technical thing you're using is paper and pencil. You know, I mean, there's so many different options and there's so many, and I think that's, you know, some of the skills gap aspects are sort of a perceptual issue of like, I can't do that because I haven't been, you know, say hacking since I was 12 years old or, you know, buying my first computer or whatever. So, you know, and so I think this is going to be a really valuable book in that regard, because I think it really sort of takes some of the fear away from people who say, well, you know, and we just had a live event where people were saying, well, I'm 50 years old. I feel like the ship sailed for me. I can't get into cybersecurity, but I want to. And I think this kind of book is going to be really valuable for people to just hear that. Right.
Yeah. Oh, and I hope so. And that's the intention, is to hit, you know, not just people who are coming out of college necessarily,
right.
but also, you know, to connect with those people who, yeah, are trying to pivot from some other role.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get there?
Yeah.
You know, I gave a TEDx talk earlier this year on the same topic and covered, you know, a barista or a retail employee and how they can make that transition.
Right.
So yeah, there's, you know, I hope that that's who I'm able to connect with, and I hope it does some good for some people and really helps them, you know, find a way in, because we need them.
Right.
We need those diverse backgrounds. We can't just all be network administrators,
yes.
system administrators, and developers.
Right.
I mean, that's not going to make us any better in security.
I totally agree. So as we're recording this, I want to sort of jump on that a little bit. We're in the middle of Pride Month, and we've seen industries and companies of all sorts do the window dressing of celebrating Pride without doing the work of equity and real inclusivity. Can you talk about some ways that the cybersecurity industry can move beyond lip service and start to embrace and foster equity and inclusion at all levels, and not just say in the month of June?
So it right back to what we were just talking about. It's recognizing the actual business value of diversity.
Yes, absolutely.
Right? It frustrates me when we have these conversations. First is the dog whistle. There
right.
is a dog whistle out there that I want to throw and smash things every time I hear it. And that's when someone says, well, what we really need is diversity of thought.
Mm.
No, duh.
Yeah.
But that is a dog whistle to say that, well, we can accomplish diversity of thought by hiring a bunch of white dudes.
Right.
No, you can't.
No.
You absolutely cannot. And you can't, you have to recognize, I mean, and there's so many examples now. Look at the AI models that were, you know, creating deepfake images of, you know, people. It turned Barack Obama into a white man.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. How did that happen?
Right.
Because of bias. Right.
Yes.
Or I think one of my favorite stories is the TSA, the new body scanners.
Mm-hmm.
And they find out these body scanners are unfairly targeting women of color.
Mm.
Why, you ask? Well, because there are certain hairstyles that are very predominant to Black women,
right,
that it was having problems with. And so isn't that kind of got you questioning now? Didn't you have any Black women in your test sets?
Yeah.
Like, shouldn't this have come up?
Right.
And so, you know, from security, it's the same thing. It's recognizing that. And so, yeah, when people say, you know, well, I want diversity of thought. Well, you better think about how you get diversity of thought.
Yes.
And then the other part of it is stop thinking of diversity as this like feel good thing. We want to, you know, make people feel good that we're inclusive and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
No, diversity yeah. is what makes us, as I said early in this podcast, it's what makes us stronger in this
exactly.
sense of collective solutioning or collective problem solving. You need those various aspects.
Right.
You need people who look at things very different ways
yep.
because of their experience. Someone who can look at a body scanner and say, what's that going to do when I walk through with my hair like this?
Yep. Yep.
Because they know from other experiences that that particular hairstyle they have gets treated differently. So those are the kinds of things we don't recognize that right now in a lot of senses. We don't see that. Like, it is actually a business value to be diverse, and it's something that you have to hire for.
Right.
Now, I'm not saying you're going to go out and say, we only want, you know, black applicants for this position. That would be illegal, right? It'd be just as illegal as saying, I only want white applicants for this position.
Yep.
But rethink what your qualifications are. What are you looking for in terms of the people you want to hire?
Yep.
And how many of those just reflect your own personal experience or your own personal biases? How can you look at what makes somebody a good fit and a good diverse fit for your team?
Mm-hmm.
Inclusive of things that maybe don't fit into what you immediately think of in terms of what that person, that role should be. So broad in that sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And not just, you know, checking off checkboxes, but also like, you know, disabled people or people, you know, neurodiverse people. Like, there's just so many places where, you know, the interfaces and the technology are being used, like you said, differently by different people. And it seems like it should be like an exciting opportunity to be meeting these people and thinking in these ways and stuff. But you know, there's that sort of feeling of like, oh God, it's June. Hurry, scramble. You know, we got to do a thing.
I mean, yeah. And I could go on for days about the rainbow washing and everything else that goes during Pride Month. Right.
I mean,
like, come on, you know, live it 12 months of the year or don't bother.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, and it's, you know, and that's actually, that reminds me of another dog whistle that's out there too, that frustrates me. And that is the, well, we want to hire the best candidate for the job.
Again,
is suggesting that, well, if I hire a black person or I hire a neurodivergent person, they're automatically less qualified.
Yeah.
No, you need to rethink your qualifications and what makes a person qualified. How are you evaluating them? Because chances are, you're not evaluating them on level playing fields. You have biases in how you evaluate.
Yep.
And as a result, you are going to be immediately shaded towards hiring someone who looks and sounds and acts like you.
Or in a similar financial situation where it's like, well, this person takes off too much time because they have family problems, or, you know, like, these are all things that I think are going to be so systemic and are going to take so long to, you know, just clean this particular attic out of all these sort of like old assumptions of like, you know, it's amazing. So, I mean, so sort of flip that around. Are there any specific things you've seen being done in this area that can act as like advice or guideposts for other organizations that want to do better, but haven't gone all in yet?
There's so many, quite honestly.
Okay.
You know, there's a lot of concrete discussion out there on how do we make ourselves more inclusive. It starts with understanding that you have to be deliberate, right? I mean, you really have to be deliberate in hiring for a diverse talent pool. You cannot, and by deliberate, I mean, you have to look at your job descriptions. You have to look at, you know, your evaluation criteria. You have to look at all of these things that are a part of just how do you even make sure that you get a diverse pool of individuals in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're not looking in the right places, I mean, that's another thing too, or looking in the same old places.
Well, yeah. And I've heard people say it a million times, you know, like, well, we really want to hire diverse, but we don't get diverse applicants.
Right.
Well, then look at your job description. What might be holding out those more diverse applicants?
Yep. Yep.
So, you know, there's, you know, I think you need to be doing that. You need to understand, and I think most HR teams do now, that unless you have an inclusive environment, you can't hire diversity because they're just going to leave anyway. If they come in and you've got a toxic, crappy environment, they don't see representation of their demographics at high levels of the organization. If you've got an all white male board, oh my God, go look at how many companies you go to their leadership page and it's all white males. Maybe they have like one woman who is in HR or marketing, right? And that's the only woman there. And there's nobody of color.
Yep.
And there's, you know, nobody with really any diversity whatsoever.
Yep.
Like, that's problematic. And you have to understand the impact that that has on your people.
Yeah. So we're working backwards from the future we want, in which our industry is fully and meaningfully become truly diverse, inclusive, and equitable. And, you know, every person who wants to contribute their skills is helped to feel safe, understood, and wholeheartedly welcomed. So, like, how did we get here? What are some long-term strategies that you've seen that are going to be most effective at breaking down these monocultural biases and prejudices?
I mean, boy, it really goes back to, again, just kind of looking at how do we get out of this mindset of the people we bring in have to have all these technical, you know, specific experiences.
Yep.
You know, when I look at job descriptions, I talk about this. And my favorite example is one from a grocery store chain in their corporate office trying to hire a security architect. And the job description goes on for 3 pages.
Wow.
It's got in intricate detail every single technology that they use, and thou must have, experience in all of these technologies. That unicorn you're looking for doesn't exist. So stop it.
Yeah.
Look at the things that are actually going to make people successful in that role. Those, you know, we talked about before, the transferable skills. That's how you know if someone's going to be good.
Right.
Right. Like, you can teach them all the skills, but, you know, you got to find the person who's got the right mindset, the right core skills, the things that, you know, are going to apply in any industry. That's what's going to tell you if they're going to be successful or not, not whether or not they've spent 10 years working with Kubernetes.
Yeah.
By the way, it hasn't existed for 10 years, folks. So stop doing that too. You know,
for sure.
Little things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, I mean, it also sort of speaks to, like, you know, you see it and you think, well, if they need me to have this exact skill set with these exact things, it doesn't speak very well to their idea of, like, their ability to train people either, because, like, they seem to want someone that they can literally just like a fuse that you can plug into a fuse box and just, like, turn them on. And then that's it. You know, like, what is your situation like that you can only take a candidate that has all of these skills already set, and you're just like, okay, I'm going to push you into that desk and you're going to deal with it.
Well, wouldn't you like them to have skills and other tools that you're not using so they can compare?
And then they can, like, tell you things that you're not doing and you're falling down on the job.
Like, yeah. Oh, great. So you use CyberArk all this time to handle your privileged access management. Oh, good. Well, you know how it works too.
Yeah.
What doesn't it do?
Right.
Somebody who's used a different PAM tool probably knows, because they've been working with it for a long time and they can tell you what it does that CyberArk doesn't do.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, things like that. It's just, again, come on, you know, we've got to think about this differently.
And also, I mean, it seems like, I mean, not to go on and on about this, but, like, there need to be sort of a change made in terms of cybersecurity teams being able to take that kind of feedback. Like, if someone comes in with a completely different background and says, you know, oh, my kind of hair is going to, you know, not go through the scanner in this certain way, or the skin color, or, you know, the way I interface because, you know, I'm legally blind or whatever, like, you know, it's still going to take some work to get security teams to take that feedback and say, oh yeah, good point. We should and not just like, oh, that's not going to happen enough times to make it worthwhile. Right. Yeah. So, I mean, there's, you know, this is going to be a hard challenge, but I'm glad we got to talk about this a little bit today. So, as we wrap up today, do you have any final career advice for listeners who might be considering cybersecurity as a career and are feeling a little intimidated by the possibilities? We talked a lot about your career guide and stuff, but I like to sort of wrap it up on a note where people sort of, like, you know, cause we get so many comments of just like, I don't know where to start. I don't know where to begin. Please help me. You know, any thoughts?
Oh yeah. Let's talk about where to start. And I'm going to give you just a little bit of a selection out of the book.
Okay.
And that is, you've got to know yourself first. Know what interests you.
Yeah.
You don't have to pick your career for life. You don't have to pick the aspect of security that you're going to be in for the rest of your life. Because the thing is, once you're in security, it's really easy to pivot around.
Right.
And go wherever you want to go. But come in with some sense of what interests you. What about security has you looking for a job here?
Mm.
And the activity I give people, the exercise I give people in the book is, if you really need to just sit down and figure this out, a great way to do it is go to some, you know, security blogs, pick 5, 10, maybe 15 security blogs and news sites and other things, and grab the headlines that interest you the most.
Mm.
You know, look back over the last few months, grab just the headlines that interest you the most from those. And now, as you get them together, now rank them out as to which ones seem most interesting. And then look for the patterns. What's in those headlines? What are those headlines talking about that, you know, what was the rest of the article? What was in there? You know, and what aspect of security was it? Was it something with IoT security? Was it something with, you know, OT security? You know,
right.
Talking about pipelines getting breached lately, or, you know, not breached, but ransomware.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, that is such an important first step, because I do get these, and I know a lot of my colleagues do too, get these messages from people looking for help. And you ask them, okay, well, what part of cybersecurity, or what do you want to do in cybersecurity? You're like, well, I just want to learn cybersecurity. I just want to learn it all.
Right.
That's a huge domain.
Yeah.
You're not going to learn it all. I don't know it all. Right. So I can't even teach you it all if that's what you're looking for.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you know yourself, know where it is that you want to go, get that and chase that initial dream, get in. And then now if you decide later, yeah, I really don't like doing threat analysis. Okay, great. So you pivot into AppSec or something. Who knows, right? I mean, you can do that.
That's some of the best career advice I think we've gotten on the show yet. So everyone who's listening, get the transcript of this, write that down and double underline it, because
and get the book,
because the exercise is in there. Absolutely. You're not choosing something that you're stuck with for the rest of your life, and choose based on your passion. So, and I love the way that was put. Thank you very much. So one last question. If our listeners want to learn more about Alyssa Miller and your book and your many awesome activities, where can they go online?
So a couple things. Online, find me on Twitter. That is by far the easiest. Okay. At @AlyssaM_InfoSec.
Mm-hmm.
You can find me on LinkedIn too if you search for Alyssa Miller or security or BISO or something. The book, if you're looking for that, the easiest way to get there is to go to alyssa.link,
mm-hmm.
alyssa.link/book. And it'll take you right to the page. Easy. It'll get you, that's a simple forwarding URL. It'll take you right to where you need to go. So if you are interested in, you know, purchasing an advanced copy, and then, you know what, you'll get the real deal once it's fully published. So.
Awesome. All right. Well, Alyssa, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your history and story with us. This was so much fun.
Yeah, thank you.
And thanks, as always, to everyone listening at home or at work, or listening at work at home for listening. New episodes of the CyberWork podcast are available every Monday at 1 p.m. Central, both on video at our YouTube page and on audio wherever fine podcasts are downloaded. And to read InfoSec's latest free ebook, Developing Cybersecurity Talent and Teams, which collects practical team development ideas compiled from industry leaders, including professionals from Raytheon, KPMG Cyber, Booz Allen, NICE, JP Morgan Chase, and more, just go to InfoSecInstitute.com/ebook and start learning today. Thank you once again to Alyssa Miller, and thank you all for watching and listening. We'll talk to you next week. How about some free cybersecurity training resources for you and your team? Just go to InfoSecInstitute.com/free to get ebooks, training guides, and more than 100 cybersecurity training courses, all free for CyberWork listeners. Go to InfoSecInstitute.com/free and start learning crucial new skills today.